Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Monday, April 15, 2024. Let the record reflect the time is 3:18 p.m. Today we have present Representative Sadler, Representative Brox, Representative Wright, Representative Carrick, Vice Chair Ruppridge, myself, Chair Sumner. The staff will be assisting us today. Kevin Allen with House Records, Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and Clark Bickford, my staff and committee aide for House Labor and Commerce. Very busy day today. We'll start with the consideration of governor's appointees, Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Commissioner Kathy Munoz. So starting with Commissioner Kathy Munoz, please approach the committee, put your name on the record, and begin your testimony about why you want to remain in this position. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Sumner and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Munoz. I am the designee for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Commissioner Designee. I've been in this role now for 15 months. I was serving many months as acting and then just recently was designated. Prior to that, I served as the Deputy Commissioner for 4 years, and in that role oversaw two of our divisions and all of the legislative work for the department. So a little bit about my background. I grew up in Juneau, longtime family ties here in the region. My great-grandparents first settled in Wrangell. They were immigrants from Sweden, and my family has been here ever since. So my grandfather and father were involved in the fisheries business. I grew up in that business, working alongside my brothers and my mom and dad in a seafood processing company that had operations in Southeast, in Yakutat, and then later up in Bristol Bay. I have a degree in political science from the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California. I also spent a year overseas at the University of Spain in Granada, returned to Juneau in 1989, ready to go to work, right? But it was during one of the biggest economic slumps in our history, there was a crash in the oil industry, and it affected all aspects of the economy. The one growth industry at that time was in tourism, so I had the opportunity to get involved in business, and I opened with my family a retail business in downtown Juneau, which I operated for about 20 years. During those years, I also served as a legislative assistant here during the winter months in the offices of Representative Gail Phillips of Homer when she was majority leader and speaker, and then Senator Lloyd Jones of Ketchikan when he was chairman of the Transportation Committee. During those years, I was elected to the City and Borough Assembly. I served 3 terms on the Borough Assembly, including 1 term as the finance chairperson for the finance process. In 2008, I was elected to the State House of Representatives. I served 4 terms in the House. I really enjoyed serving the community and the region, really. You know, I had a lot of work that supported economic development in the region, and jobs was very central to my work. Also, I had a lot of experience around vocational education. I was involved in a number of efforts to improve our vocational education offerings in the state. Oh, gosh, I have 2 great kids. I'm married to Juan, who's here with me today, and Juan is the son of the late Reed Munoz, Alaskan artist. We have 2 kids. Mercedes is here in Juneau. She's a working artist, and she has 2 young kids. She's married to Billy, who's a school principal here in Juneau. My son, Matthew, is a senior in high school, so there's a big age difference between the two, but he's getting ready to graduate and go off to college in the fall. So it's a really exciting time in our household, planning for that next big step in his life. This past year, and I want to say also my mom is here in Juneau, so if she's watching, hi, Mom. She's probably watching. So it's really a great, just a joy to have her here in the community and doing well. She lives in the house that where I was raised and where my father was raised, and just up the hill, so I get to have lunch with her most days. This past year, I've challenged the department leadership to really focus on ways to connect people to employment, to increase training opportunities, and really to improve our business processes. And so around training, our training support is up by about 85%. That's this year and last year compared to previous years. And I attribute that in large part to a successful ad campaign that we had last year targeting 18 to 30-year-olds to get industry-certified trainings. These are short-term trainings that are supported through our job centers. Really happy with that outcome. We also have expanded income eligibility. Previously, it was very restrictive, especially for our federal monies. We have a much more flexibility in making people eligible for those federal Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act funding now. So that's seen a great increase in our participation. We're also in partnership with the Department of Education and Early Development, implementing a career guide project. We heard from industry at a convening that we had last October that one of the issues that they face is a need for a greater career awareness around technical jobs. And so we're working with the Department of Ed to put career counselors in our job centers in Ketchikan, Bethel, and Fairbanks initially. Those individuals will work closely with the schools in the districts around pre-apprenticeship, around industry connections, jobs, and the training that is necessary to go into those high-paying jobs once they get out of high school. And then military partnership, we were just recently named a Department of Defense SkillBridge site, so we're very interested in expanding our opportunities, partnerships with the military community. SkillBridge is a program that covers the first 6 months of wages for individuals that are exiting active service. Our success is something that we want to share with other businesses and entities. So I've directed the staff to work with businesses that are interested in becoming SkillBridge sites to help them through that process. Then we have the Office of Citizenship Assistance, which I'm very proud of. This is a bill or a law that was passed about 20 years ago to establish an office in the commissioner's office to help individuals as they're transitioning, legal immigrants and refugees transitioning to employment in Alaska. It was funded for a short period of time, 20 years ago when it first started, and then it kind of phased out. So I'm really very interested in getting that going again and helping people be successful in employment. It's a win-win situation for business and industry and individuals coming to our state. We want them to be successful with training and employment, language translation services, credential translation, and the like. In closing, I would just say it's been a real honor to serve, and I've worked with all of you closely. I really appreciate the work that you do and the support that you have for the department and for vocational education and career training in general. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. Do any members have questions for the Commissioner? Representative Fields.
Thank you. Not a question, but a comment through the chair. Just wanted to thank you, Commissioner Munoz, for always being responsive in terms of inquiries that I've had. And I also want to thank you for your support of apprenticeship at the state level, at the local level, and also for your work on helping new citizens get jobs and support themselves.
Thank you very much.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. Thanks for being here, Commissioner, and for the work you do for workforce development. Also, I see that you were on the governor's task force on child care. So I was just curious, what are some of the challenges and opportunities that you hope to address as commissioner, continuing to be commissioner on child care?
So the task force delivered its first of three reports last November, and many of the recommendations are already being implemented that would streamline the permitting process for getting new facilities up and running. We've identified a number of barriers, for instance, with something like, well, with fingerprinting, for instance, the difficulty for rural communities to access fingerprinting services. So we're proposing to put fingerprinting at state office facilities around the state. I mean, it sounds like a simple solution, but it's one that would have a very positive impact on a number of our facilities, especially in rural communities. We're also doing a cost study of the cost of what it involves to provide childcare, and looking at, you know, support for individual families, possibly broadening the state support to make more people eligible for state-supported childcare. Just a lot of different innovative strategies. I think there's legislation, as you know, going through the process that addresses tax credits and the sort. And so we're at a time where I think all kind of ships are pointed in the right direction, right? We understand that childcare is a very important factor to successful employment. And so I think we're going to see some positive outcomes of this work.
Okay. Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, thank you for your work. This has been fun. But a specific citizenship assistance. Specifically, there's appears to be a number of teachers coming in working in rural areas, mm-hmm. and they are on a 3-year visa or something like that. Have you discovered anything we can do? Apparently, number of them would like to stay longer. Have you been involved with that, or is that a new thing that we need to get involved with?
We have been involved, and it's interesting to note that there are approximately 200 individuals, mostly Filipino teachers, that are in many of our rural schools and very successful, very well supported in those communities. And you're right, they're on a limited visa, J-1 visa. And so we look to advocate for those individuals to have extensions to their visa. And we're also working very closely through Deputy Commissioner Nelson San Juan and the Office of Citizenship Assistance in supporting them and being successful as they transition, especially out to the rural communities, where culturally, you know, they're coming from sometimes urban areas in Manila and going to a rural community. It's really important to make sure that they're prepared for that transition so that they're successful.
That's good to hear. Would like to follow up with that sometime before we get out of here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Representative Wright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Commissioner, I just wanted to thank you for coming and presenting to us today and putting your name forward. I really appreciate the opportunity to hear your story again. I know it, and I've worked with you in the past, and I really appreciate that opportunity as well. So thank you, and I see some folks in the room here who are supporting you, a lot of folks, and I just want to make sure everybody knows that that's out there as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Representative.
Okay. Now going to open public testimony on the appointment of Kathy Munoz as Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify? Please approach, put your name on the record, and begin your testimony. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Don Etheridge with the AFL, Alaska AFL-CIO, and here to support designee commissioner, and hope she drops that designee soon and becomes commissioner. It's been a pleasure to work with her over the years. Her and I served on the assembly together back years ago, and before that, I even sold fish to her father. But we don't agree on everything, but on the things that we don't, we're usually able to work it out and come up with a good solution to make everybody at least the same amount of mad about it. That's a fair deal when you could do that. And yeah, we fully support Kathy for the commissioner's position. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else in the room wishing to testify? Please approach, put your name on the record, and begin your testimony.
Chair Sumner.
Please put your name on the record and go ahead with your testimony. Thank you.
Members of the Senate, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony this afternoon. Please excuse me for reading it. I'd like to make sure I don't take too much of your time. My name is Rebecca Carrillo. I am here to support the confirmation of designee Kathy Munoz for the Commissioner of the Department of Labor. My name is Rebecca Carrillo. Well, I've already said that. I have lived in Juneau for 43 years and worked for the state of Alaska for 33 years in the public as the Public Health Administration. As a retiree, I am grateful for Kathy Munoz for carrying legislation addressing $3 billion in unfunded liabilities, to stabilize and safeguard the retirement of thousands of Alaska State employees like me. She was instrumental in establishing the Philippine Honorary Council for Alaska, an office I am proud to have served on behalf of 26,000 Filipino Americans in the state. The programs Kathy Munoz and key staff has implemented, such as Alaska looks to lead the way in youth employment outcomes, resulting in Alaska's selection as one of the 9 teams from across communities in the nation to participate in Youth Systems Building Academy administered by the U.S. Department of Labor is a huge honor for the state. As a parent of a military veteran, whom nothing makes one aware of issues, good or bad, that affects the military when your child has been through the lines of the front lines of war. The agreement with the U.S. Department of Defense to become a skill bridge partner is a lifeline for military service members exiting, returning to civilian life. Finally, in many conversations with Kathy, it is clear that her philosophy, life values of inclusion, diversity, tolerance, providing opportunities and lifting those around her are all echoed in the vision and mission of her work as head of the department. The new workforce, 2030, the Alaska Plan, a multi-agency collaboration to develop strategies to meet the challenges of Alaska's workforce shortages, is a hopeful approach to this statewide problem. She will undoubtedly be laser-focused on these issues. Therefore, I urge you to consider her confirmation as Commissioner of the Department of Labor. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wright.
Honorary Counsel. Thank you. I really appreciate your testimony, and knowing that you're a pillar in the community, I will definitely take that into consideration. Thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, just briefly, Ms. Carrillo, thank you very much for your testimony. And thank you for your service as well. I know you've done a lot for our state and appreciate you coming out and speaking today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else in the room wishing to testify? Please approach, put your name on the record, and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman, and to the members of the committee. I'm here to support Kathy Munoz's nomination as a commissioner for the Department of Labor. I'm Jimmy Yap. I'm currently one of the board of directors of the Filipino community here in Juneau, Alaska. And I am a former State of Alaska employee, too. I am honored to share my heartfelt testimony about Commissioner Kathy Munoz. She's a remarkable individual who has left an indelible mark on the Filipino community in Alaska, actually not only among Filipinos, but for all Alaskans. Kathy has been more than just a friend of Filipinos in Juneau. She has been a bridge of friendship and understanding between the people of Alaska and the Filipino community. Her unwavering commitment and dedication were evident in her pivotal role in designating the Manila Square, you can see it in downtown area, to honor the contributions of Filipinos in Juneau, and in making a province in the Philippines, Aklan, a sister city of Juneau, Alaska, just to name a few. Through her tireless efforts, she helped forge a bond that transcended borders and celebrated the rich cultural heritage of both regions. Beyond her official duties, Kathy actively participated in various events and activities of the Filipino community, showcasing her genuine interest and support for our community. Whether it was attending cultural celebrations, lending a helping hand in community projects, or simply being a compassionate listener, Kathy's presence was always felt and appreciated. Kathy Munoz's warmth, kindness, and genuine passion for fostering unity and friendship had touched the hearts of many. Her legacy will continue to inspire us to embrace the diversity, build bridges of understanding, and strive for a more inclusive and harmonious society. These attributes make her a great nominee for us as a commissioner for the Department of Labor and Workforce. Thank you, Kathy, for being a beacon of unity and friendship. Your contributions will forever be cherished and remembered by the Filipino community in Alaska in particular, and Alaskans in general. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, is there anybody else in the room wishing to testify? Oh, please approach. Put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay. Right here. Good afternoon, Chairman, Vice Chairman, and all the members of the House of Legislative Committee on Labor and Workforce Development. My name is Terry Abaro. I flew in from Anchorage yesterday to be here with our soon-to-be commissioner, Kathy Munoz. I'm the founder and organizer of the Alaska Asia Pacific Chamber of Commerce. Its information, and was also a director of human resources and workforce development for a seafood company for 23 years. So I have seen Kathy Munoz since she became the Deputy Labor Commissioner back in 2018. Actually worked with her, but prior to that, I have seen her in action since 2012. Kathy is all about hiring Alaskans. She's all about training Alaskans to make sure that the jobs match with the skills of Alaskans. She's everywhere. I've seen her at the Alaska Job Corps Center in Palmer. I've seen her at the Alaska Vocational Technical Center, AFTEC, in Seward. I've seen her at the Alaska Safety Alliance monthly meetings on workforce development. I've seen her during the reestablishment of the OCA. I've seen her at different job centers, whether it's in Anchorage, in Juneau, in Fairbanks. And I've seen her in different engagement events in Wasilla, in Juneau, in Anchorage, and many other parts of Alaska. She's about enhancing opportunities for Alaskans to acquire valuable skills to be able for them to contribute to Alaska's economy and to ensure that all Alaskans have access to quality training and learning experiences. She's all that. That's what Kathy is about. Kathy has collaborated with various stakeholders, including government agencies, unions, industry representatives, business employers, workers, and community organizations, therefore demonstrating her extraordinary ability to build consensus and foster positive relationships with all Alaskans. So I'm so fortunate that I'm able to be working with her side by side and being to tell you exactly what kind of a person Kathy Munoz is. For the last 7 years, she's all about, making sure that all Alaskans are given the proper opportunity and the proper training to be able to find the best, you know, qualified job for them. And she's definitely the right person to continue to lead the State of Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Thank you so much for listening to my testimony. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay, is there anybody else in the room wishing to testify?
That's it?
Yep.
No questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you. we appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Okay. We are going to go online. I have a Tom Boutin. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Yeah, thank you. Tom Boutin, Juneau here, and thanks for having the hearing, and thanks for all the hard work you do for all Alaskans, all of you on the committee there. Just want to support Kathy Mignot's, of course, for getting confirmed in this particular job that she's been doing right along. Labor is a department that is seldom in the news, but it has some essential responsibilities. I bet I've known 10 or more labor commissioners. What you want in the top job of labor, but really any state agency, is someone that will just keep their head down and do the work and avoid trouble. Avoid controversy. But you also want somebody that'll look at a situation or a plan that the department has or the whole administration, frankly, and say, gee, what are we really doing here? This might be nuts. Let's think about this. And government just can't find enough people who will do that. And Kathy brings that kind of common sense to the job. She has done so in other jobs. She did so on the Juneau Assembly. And I think anybody would, anybody we all know, you know, would say she certainly did that as a member of the House. She'll continue to keep the department out of trouble as she's been doing, and she'll make sure the work gets done. And that's all I had. Thank you again for the hearing.
Well, thank you. Okay, so seeing no other testimony, we will close public testimony. Thank you, Commissioner. Vice Chair Ruffridge, do you have a motion?
I think you read the motion, Mr. Chair.
Do I? Brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. Sorry about that. In accordance with AS 3905.080, the Labor and Commerce Committee has held a hearing on the Commissioner of Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Kathy Munoz. Signature on this report does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals during further sessions. And we will take it at ease and sign the committee report. Okay, we are back on the record. Next on the let the record reflect that Representative Fields joined us at 3:20 p.m. I think it was. Next on the agenda is House Bill 187, prior authorization, a bill sponsored by my office. Today we're going to have a first bill hearing on House Bill 187. I'd like to invite my staff, Serena Hackmiller. Please approach the committee, put your name on the record, and proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Serena Hackmiller. I'm the staff to Rep. Sumner, Chair Sumner. House Bill 187 is prior auth exemption for health providers. I'm going to go first read the sponsor statement, and if it pleases the chair, we may forego the sectional for the interest of time.
I think we will.
Okay. Thank you. HB 187 aims to reduce the wait time for certain healthcare services by exempting healthcare providers from making pre-authorization requests for said services. Currently, Alaskans who need certain healthcare services must wait days and even weeks at a time to get pre-authorized to receive healthcare services because of the processing time between the healthcare provider and insurance companies. This bill would help Alaskans receive healthcare services immediately, especially healthcare services that could save their lives. This bill would create a utilization review entity that may evaluate whether a healthcare provider continues to qualify for an exemption if during the most recent 12-month period, the utilization review entity has approved or would approve at least 80% of the prior authorization requests submitted by the healthcare provider for that healthcare service. The healthcare provider is not required to request an exemption to qualify for an exemption. A utilization review may not deny or reduce payment for a healthcare service that is exempted. Other states with prior authorization exemptions have seen increased frequency of patients who receive the healthcare services they need expediently. This bill would help Alaskans receive fast, efficient, and quality healthcare when they need it without waiting for a pre-authorization process that could cause their health to decline even more. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mrs. Hackenmiller. We are going to go into invited testimony at this time. First, I have Jeff Davis. If you'd please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. My name is Jeffrey Davis, and I'm pleased to be here and have this opportunity to speak to you today on House Bill 187. I've had an opportunity to speak in front of several of you prior. I'm happy to have this chance to do it again. So I said, my name is Jeffrey Davis. I'm a healthcare consultant. I work for a company called Radiation Business Solutions, but provide healthcare consulting to a number of other types of healthcare entities. By way of introduction, I've worked in various roles in healthcare in Alaska since 1986 and was the president of Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska from 1996 to 2013. I've also spent many years working on the provider side of this equation. Most recently, 5 years in some intensive provider roles and the last 3 years in radiation oncology. And I'm here today as an interested party to provide my perspective on something that I think is very important to Alaskans and hopefully can share some experiences from both sides of this question. To me, House Bill 187 is primarily about patient protection. It is often in the debate talked about in terms of the impact on providers and payers, but it is a fact that patients bear the cost of unnecessary prior authorization and the delays that come from that in the form of physical, emotional, and financial harm from those delays. And yes, it impacts physicians and payers, but the patient is the most important. Study after study shows this to be true. It is not theoretical, but in fact, undocumented harm caused by treatment abandonment or degradation of conditions while waiting for treatment and other negative impacts. The original goals of prior authorization were well-meaning, but because of unchecked expansion, the tool has become a problem instead of a solution. It's important to emphasize that this bill does not eliminate prior authorization because there are still some legitimate reasons that it makes sense. Instead, this bill seeks to restore balance to a situation that has become very much one-sided in favor of the payers. To make a point of that, most providers in Alaska are now in networks with payers, and those payer contracts almost universally require the provider to adhere to the payer's utilization review programs, but also specify that compliance includes any changes the payer puts in place in the future. So while you enter into a contract with one set of provisions, it can change at any time. And in most cases, the provider's only recourse if they disagree with those provisions is to terminate the contract, which is not good for their patients or anyone else. So these provisions allow the payers to add additional layers of authorization with no checks and balances, leaving patients and providers to be the ones who bear the costs at the whim of the payer. And the result has been increasing levels of requirements mandating providers to submit prior authorization, oftentimes for the same procedure or test over and over again. When recent studies show providers spend an average of 10 to 15% of their time, and these are physicians, on prior authorization, which is a significant loss of productivity and expense. And this happens, this 10 to 15% investment of their time, despite the fact that eventual approval rates are as high as 95%. And all the while, the patients wait to see if their care will be approved. And it's important to note that the routine approval, so if something is approved within the time frame set out in Alaska law, which is 5 days for a routine, 1 day for emergent, that's not really the issue we're talking about here. What we're talking about is the fact that there are a huge number, significant number of times that prior authorization is requested and there's an initial denial by the payer. In fact, some payers have taken to denying every request for proven treatments, hoping to force the provider to adopt a different course than they have deemed best for their patient. And when that happens, when there's an initial denial and it goes now into a formal patient type appeal, but an appeal of the denial by the provider, it can take weeks and months of delay that Ms. Swanoff was talking about earlier. And to make matters worse, many payers delegate this responsibility for prior authorization to third parties. And those third parties are often paid based on their rate of denial. And when the appeal to that third party is exhausted and it must go to the payer itself, that results in additional delays. House Bill 187 restores balance to this patient-physician relationship in that if a provider has shown themselves to have been approved by going through all the different steps that they are forced to go through, and they have achieved an acceptance rate or approval rate of 80% or more, they're not the ones that prior authorization was designed to detect and correct. They're not the ones that are at risk for performing unnecessary services or committing fraud or abuse, and they're the ones who should be exempt. And finally, I think it's important to point out that payers themselves have adopted this type of program, gold card programs, and they have put those in place because they recognize that it makes sense to exempt those who have a track record of exceptional performance. House Bill 187 makes those same protections that the payers have put in place available to the providers who meet the standard without the need for a one-by-one-by-one costly and time-consuming individual negotiation with payer to achieve that same status. So House Bill 187 reduces patient harm, reduces costly administrative waste, and is sound public policy. And I applaud you for considering this important change to protect Alaskans. Thank you for letting me share with you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have Pam Venkin. Yes. Ms. Venkin, if you put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. My name is Pam Venkin. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska State Medical Association. I have in the past, but I no longer work in physician offices, but I talk to physicians on a regular basis, and virtually all prior authorizations are denied at the first level. And this forces practices to hire additional staff solely to do the follow-up and appeals of the prior authorization denials. Appeals take time, and when a service is denied and it has to be appealed over and over to higher and higher levels, it can take weeks and months. And in the meantime, patients are being denied adequate care. When the claim finally does get to a final peer-to-peer review, it often isn't always a physician that does that review. Sometimes it's a nurse, sometimes it's a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. And rarely is that physician reviewer of the same specialty as the physician requesting the prior authorization. And so the requesting physician who deals in this particular disease or condition on a regular basis has to educate the reviewer about the new technology, the new drugs that might be available, and the current standard of care. All of this takes time. This is true also when prescriptions need prior authorization. And it goes through a number of people with delays in patient care, and sometimes those delays cause emergency room visits or hospitalizations. On average, a physician in practice is, according to prescription pharmacy people, 33 prescriptions per week of requiring prior authorization that takes an average of 14 hours of physician time every week. This is time that could be spent in patient care, and in the meantime, patients are being delayed in getting their medications. So the State Medical Association heartily supports House Bill 187, and we urge you to pass this bill after review. Thank you. I'm here to answer any questions.
Thank you. Next, we have John Kelly. If you'd please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, thank you for inviting me to offer some input into this bill. My name is John Kelly. I'm a neurologist, currently practicing in Wasilla and expanding into Fairbanks this summer. This bill is important to me because I deal with prior authorizations on a daily basis. Comments were made earlier to the effect that a physician spends 10 to 15% of their time dealing with prior authorizations. I say that's conservatively correct. I'm going to focus on one particular disease state. In fact, I'm going to focus on one particular patient because she is emblematic of the problem that we face trying to provide the best care to patients. So this patient I'm going to tell you about is in her early 30s. She's a veterinarian. She is an extremely competitive athlete. She's one of these long-distance runners, and I think last weekend she was out on her bicycle with the fat tires riding up and down a snowy mountain in some kind of race. And so a very active individual who's recently been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. This is a disease where, and I've been in practice for 34 years, and if I go back to my early days, when we would diagnose people with multiple sclerosis, we really didn't have much to offer them at all. We could give them high-dose steroids when they were having an attack, and then otherwise we would just sit back and wait for the next attack and do the same thing, and the next attack and do the same thing. And even patients who have recovery, for the most part, between attacks, every attack takes its toll, just like small strokes would cumulatively affect someone. So it's a progressive disease. Even when it seems to be relapsing and remitting, there's still a progressive component to it, and disability begins to arise. It can affect anything from motor function, bladder control, vision, even cognitive function declines over time when MS remains unchecked or inadequately treated. So we went from that state of the disease to jump forward to now, where we have our treatments are so advanced and have come so far that when I diagnose patients with multiple sclerosis, and I've had about five of them in the past month, I can tell them that I can virtually promise them that their quality of life is going to be good, that they'll never face a nursing home, they'll never face a wheelchair. It's extremely unlikely that they will have to shorten their work life. They can live with this disease now, and we can keep it in remission or near complete remission for the rest of their lives because of the quality of the medications that we have now. So flipping back to my veterinarian patient, there's three medications that really stand out in that ability to control the disease. There's lots of them that got us to this point that don't have that degree of benefit. So when I when she and I discussed her options, we decided on an intravenous treatment that would be once every 6 months. It would fit great with her lifestyle. She could come in, have an appointment, get her infusion, and go on about her life until 6 months later, come back in for another recheck. It was really a very nice fit for her. Her insurance company balked, said, nope, we're not going to approve that. And interestingly, the first message I got was, well, that's not on our approved list of medications. They gave me a list of some of the older medications that are much more prone to side effects, definitely less efficacious. Drugs that I used to prescribe a long time ago that really aren't appropriate in today's world. Interestingly, the pharmacist at the specialty pharmacy, who was representing, in this case, the prior authorization person, said to me, if you'll just go ahead and change your order to one of these other drugs, then we won't have to issue a denial. And my response was, oh, no, you go ahead and issue the denial. I want that on record that you're denying my patient the best treatment that she can have. So they did, and then I subsequently had a phone call with another physician to discuss the case. I started off by explaining that the request I was making was for a drug that is the least expensive of all the multiple sclerosis disease-modifying drugs. It's the least expensive, it's the most efficacious, and it has an excellent side effect profile, very well tolerated once every 6 months. And she said, no, hold on, we're not going to go there. I'm just here to read off the insurance company's list of criteria. Let's go through that. So have you ever tried this? No, why not? I don't think it's the most appropriate drug. Well, have you ever tried this one? So we went through the list of drugs and a series of other questions. And at the end, she said, so let me see if I got this right. So you want, instead of their preferred list of drugs, you want a drug that is less expensive, has much greater efficacy, stands likelihood of putting the patient in complete remission with a very low side effect profile that she only has to get once every 6 months instead of daily or what have you. And I said, I know, sounds crazy, doesn't it? So she went ahead and wouldn't tell me her decision as they typically don't on the phone. But we received a notice today that it was approved. That took a lot of my time. It took my staff's time. And that's kind of the whole point. This is where the prior authorization process went awry. Thankfully, I knew I'd win on appeal. I absolutely knew I would. They had nothing to stand on, not financial, nothing clinical. I knew I'd win it, but it was the time involved that's aggravating. And the poor patient, it was just beyond herself. That's a whole other story. She called the insurance company and they said, oh, no, we've never even received the request. They had, but they forwarded it to a specialty pharmacy. It's all these games that are played that are just so aggravating. So I've got a patient who's burning hot, mad, thinking that we didn't do anything and we're lying to her. And we're like, no, we sent it in. My guess is it probably went to a specialty pharmacy and that's exactly what happened. So it's just, hopefully you can hear in my voice the aggravation that I deal with on a daily basis. I'm just trying to do the best I can for these patients and give patients this the quality of life that they deserve that we're now able to offer them with this disease. And yet I feel like having to drag the insurance company behind me in these efforts. It's very frustrating. This is just one example of the type of thing that we deal with. It's fresh in my mind because I've been dealing with it this week. And I appreciate the opportunity to tell you her story. Hopefully we can co-name this bill Sarah's bill in her honor if it's approved. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kelly. Next we have Jared Cosen. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jared Cosen, and I am the President and CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. On behalf of Alaska's hospitals, our association strongly supports House Bill 187 and urges its passage. HB 187 works to address what has become a major problem in healthcare, and that is the prior authorization process used by insurers. So at first glance, prior authorization can seem like a reasonable approach for reviewing certain uses of medical procedures and medications to ensure efficiency and quality of care. But just as we've heard, especially from Dr. Kelly, it's evolved into a weapon that's used by insurers to delay and deny healthcare. I mean, this results in unconscionable delays for patients, and it injects complete waste into our healthcare system with the administrative burdens it puts on providers. Dr. Kelly is case in point with the story he just told. This is an issue being widely discussed across the country. I was with colleagues, physicians, and other healthcare leaders in Washington, D.C. this past weekend, and prior authorization and the abuses therein was one of the most widely discussed issues. And this is because the stories of harm to patients are heartbreaking. And I will say again, as Dr. Kelly was so perfectly put on record, it's all for nothing. There are stories in Alaska and across the country about patients with terminal illnesses literally losing the final months of their lives because insurance companies initially denied care through prior auth, but ultimately approved the care, but it was only after weeks and weeks and weeks of appeals and peer-to-peer reviews with the physician. What is the point of all of this? Is it worth putting immense stress on patients? Is it worth making our providers spend their time on paperwork instead of caring for these patients? We believe the answer is no, it's not worth it. And we think House Bill 187 is a reasonable solution as it keeps the prior authorization process in place, but it creates an efficient administrative pathway for those proven providers who've navigated this process and have been approved a vast majority of the time. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, the bill sponsor, for bringing this legislation forward, and we urge this committee to pass House Bill 187. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. We are going to set this bill aside for a future date, given that our committee is mostly made up of HESS members who have heard this bill several times this session. I'm going to set an amendment deadline on House Bill 187 for Monday morning, April 22nd at 11 a.m. Last week, we had a hearing on House Bill 313, and today we're going to continue the amendment process on House Bill 313, Public Utility Regulatory Cost Charge, a bill by the request of the governor. We have one amendment to hear today, and I move amendment number 3. Okay, there is objection.
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. Okay, we are back on the record. Amendment number 3 simply exempts from rate regulation residential trash collection companies in areas of competition. And I offer this amendment because I have seen in my own area, I believe maybe 6 different trash haulers. And what will happen is the rates will be set for one. You'll see the cans on the street. They'll be all different colors, representing the different competing companies. And one trash hauler will have a set uncompetitive rate, and the colors will slowly change. And then they will go through their rate regulatory process, which takes a significant amount of time. and then the colors will slowly change the other way, and it seems wasteful, in my opinion. But Representative Carrick, if you'd like to speak to your objection, or Representative Fields. Sorry, Representative Fields is recognized.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I guess my observation is the Regulatory Commission says they don't have the staff to focus on the bigger issues, and why are we bogging them down with these smaller issues? So I would support it for the same reason I supported exempting some of the smaller projects.
Okay. Representative Carrick?
I'm just a question on the amendment. In areas where we don't have competing trash collection services, how does the RCA, I guess, how does that work outside of like Anchorage and the Mat-Su? And I'm trying to think of the Fairbanks trash collection, but I don't know if you could speak a little bit to outside of Anchorage and Mat-Su area, or if anyone can.
I could speak to it, but we also have Robert Doyle and Becky Alvey online for questions if you'd like.
Yeah, it's pretty generic, but I'd be interested in hearing from one or both of them, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Doyle, if you heard the question from Representative Carrick, or if you'd like her to restate, it was basically how does the RCA regulate trash, residential trash collection in areas outside of competitive areas?
Yes, sir. This is Robert Doyle with the RCA. And to answer the question in a little broader piece, it's right now we do have competition. And so this would cover the following communities: Mat-Su, Anchorage, Delta, Fairbanks, Kenai, Haines, and Juneau all have two or more utilities that are competing. Elsewhere, it could happen throughout the state where there's more than one utility competing. If there's only one, we go through the normal rate-making process to make sure that rates are just and reasonable, both for the utility to remain solvent and stay in service, that they're fit, able, and willing to provide that service since it's singular and more monopolistic, and also that the ratepayers are being able to keep those rates as low as possible with avoiding rate shock. So, and the way we've approved the competition in Mat-Su and other places, as we do believe competition is kind of an ultimate form of regulation. When it works properly, the free market system is something that allows that competition and is a form of regulating itself. It's usually just when we have a monopoly where we've given somebody a certificate of public convenience and necessity, like an electrical utility where there's only one service, that we do really need to make sure that we do the regulation to make sure that that service is, again, fit, able, and willing, and that the ratepayers have a reasonable rate that's justified and reasonable. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Doyle. Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you. Well, I guess to the sponsor or Mr. Doyle, I'm all for it, by the way, but two questions. First one is, why limit to residential? Could this be applied to commercial as well?
Oh, I can answer that, Representative Prox. Quite simply, in competitive markets, we do not regulate the commercial trash pickup. It is only the residential that is subject to rate regulation.
Right. Yes. Okay, good. Thank you. Good to know. The other, just as a practical matter, if there is one, that company is regulated, and then the second company can come on, and then what happens? Meaning, should we just completely deregulate? The mechanics of the second company showing up.
Representative Prox, I would recommend against complete deregulation in markets where there is no competition. I mean, I believe that the reason we have an RCA regulations is to protect consumers against monopolistic abuses. But where you do have competition, I think it's proper to, or maybe deregulate. Thank you.
And just to follow up, I might be overthinking this, but if the second company shows up, they would initially be regulated or have to apply to be regulated? And like I say, I'm only familiar with the Fairbanks, North Scarborough area, so I don't know. Maybe this isn't a concern.
Well, thank you, Representative Prox. And actually, under our current statutes and before this amendment and the bill, if it should pass with this amendment, we do exempt residential trash collection companies under a certain size from regulation already. So it is only the larger ones. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got one chair, one question for you, Mr. Chairman, and one question for Mr. Doyle. My first question is to you. Actually, maybe they're both for Mr. Doyle. Does the RCA currently identify what is an area on line 9 of this amendment? There is a residential country in an area where two or more utilities. Is that a political subdivision? Is that a borough, a city? Is there a service area? Just how do we define area?
I'll invite some feedback from Becky Alvey as well, but the answer is yes. Everybody has a service area. It's not necessarily going to be tied to a political subdivision. It really it depends what that particular, in this case, residential waste collection service wants to provide. And so it could be bigger or smaller, and we would just take that into account. Becky, do you have anything you wanted to add?
For the record, Becky Alvey, the advisory section manager of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, through the chair. When we get an application for any type of service, so if we're specific to refuse, they're going to specify which area. We do not, and that is their service area. We do not define area in our statute, but every utility operates under their certificate under a service area, and that service area is set when we approve their application. And then that would be, if they changed any part of their service area, they would come in and request that as well. But it's going to be defined with their certificate. And if they have a tariff, their service area has a map, and that's laid out in their tariff as well.
What I'm kind of getting to is we are exempting trash services from regulation if a certain couple of contingencies or conditions are met, that being they provide identical service and operate in an area. I want to make sure that those areas remain consistent. So I don't know if somebody, if one company exists and a competitor comes in, if changing your service area slightly would allow you to evade the impact of this. I'm just trying to understand if your regulations and operations allow for that and deal with it. That's a question to RCA if someone wants to.
Okay, this is Robert Doyle from the RCA again through the chair. If you had two companies in Matsu and somebody was wanting to compete in just the Wasilla area proper and not do Big Lake, not do Meadow Lake, not do Palmer, we would take a look at that. And I would believe that that would be competitive service within the Wasilla area. And I don't necessarily believe, because people are going to have to pick kind of a density that they're willing to, that they believe that they can make a go of it. And so they're probably going to have to come in and say, this is what our expected cash flow is. This is what the reason we believe this is a viable business. And we would take a look at all those things. So I'm not sure if somebody was having a non-identical service area, but it overlapped. I still think that would be kind of considered as a competitive service. So we wouldn't, in those particular cases, if this passes as a policy guidance, then we wouldn't be regulating them. But maybe this is more of a question for the sponsor of the bill.
No, actually, through the chairman, Mr. Doyle, Commissioner Doyle, that does answer. So it sounds like if there's overlap, then that overlapping area constitutes an area where there was competition. Therefore, the two competitors would be free from the RCA regulation. That answers my question clearly. Thank you. And my second question, if I may, Mr. Chair, is what is the same kind of term, identical service? How identical do they have to be? Same equipment, same hours of operation? How much leeway is involved in identical service?
Through the chair, this is Robert Doyle, RCA. Identical service would be basically limited to residential waste collection services. They could be different types of trucks, and the sponsor of the legislation is perfectly correct. There's going to be different size trucks. There could be different size equipment. There could be different hours of operation. They would have to put together their business model and say, this is what we believe. We can make a go of it. And then you have your competing services. So that's as simple as I could make it. I don't see anything more difficult than that, than unless the sponsor of the bill wants to weigh in on that.
No, well, I'll just say that satisfied me. Is I want to make sure I have a clear record for anybody trying to interpret this later on. So that answer satisfies me.
And thank you, Representative Sadler. And I would just state, maybe as a legislative intent matter, that it's not my intent that a monopolistic service provider be able to grab a small competitive area, then not be subject in their monopolistic area, that there would have to be substantial overlap in those service areas. And I guess there is objection, so please.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to remove my objection.
Oh, okay. Well, without objection, Amendment number 3 is passed. Vice Chair, seeing no other business for the committee on HB 313, Vice Chair Ruffridge, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Chair Sumner. I move.
Representative Wright.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Sumner. I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill number. Brief at ease.
Okay, we're back on the record. Representative Wright.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. I move the committee substitute for House Bill number 313, version alpha, also referred to as 33GH2516 alpha, be advanced from committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
I object. Okay. There's objection. Representative Ruffridge, you'd like to speak to your objection?
Just briefly, Chair Sumner, I just think that this ability right now to increase the regulatory cost charge that is produced and passed on to ratepayers is really actually not appropriate at this time, and I wish to object to this bill moving forward.
Okay. There is objection. Please call the roll.
Representative Crox?
Yes.
Representative Ruffridge?
No.
Representative Sadler?
Yes.
Representative Wright?
Yes.
Representative Carrick?
Yes.
Representative Fields?
Yes.
Chair Sumner?
Yes.
6 yeas, 1 nay.
Okay. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the bill file. We are back on the record. With 6 yeas and 1 nay, House Bill 313 shall be reported from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the bill file. Okay, we're back on the record. Next on the agenda is House Bill 394, Regulate Natural Gas Storage Facility, a bill by House Resources. We heard this bill during the last meeting and set an amendment deadline. We received 3 amendments before the deadline. First, Representative Carrick.
Brief at ease, Mr. Chair.
Brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. Correct, we received 5 amendments around the deadline. Representative Carrick.
I move amendment number 1, U.5.
Objection for purposes of discussion.
Okay, there is objection. Representative Carrick.
Okay, amendment number 1 would remove the required confidentiality from House Bill 394. When we were talking with the RCA Commissioner Doyle at our last hearing, I had asked the question, are the confidentiality requirements or process for gaining an exemption overly cumbersome or burdensome on folks? And they said no. So amendment number 1 removes from the language of the bill sections 4, 9, and 10 There is already a petition process for records to be made confidential. And again, in response to Commissioner Doyle's testimony, it sounds like our current system is efficient and sufficient to continue having an exemption process. So I don't see a need to decrease that transparency and make a special carve out, which is what we currently have in this legislation.
Okay. Representative Wright.
I'd like to hear from the bill sponsor.
Yes. Representative McKay, staff, if you'd like to come forward, speak to amendment number one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom McKay, Chair of House Resources, District 15, Anchorage. And I guess I wanted to just make a, well, I better not make an opening comment because we're talking about an amendment. So I'll let my staff, Trevor Jepson, address Amendment 1. Thank you.
Okay. For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay. As acknowledged in our initial bill hearing on this, as Representative Carrick noted, there is a petition process that you have to apply for to receive confidentiality of financial records. However, we crafted this bill working with private industry, and they made it very clear that if that financial confidentiality wasn't clear from the outset, there would be a non-starter for starting the petition process to register reservoirs for gas storage. So we strongly oppose this amendment, and if it were to pass, the bill would be moot, null, and void. Thank you, Chair Sumner.
Okay. All right. There is objection. Please call the roll on amendment number one.
Representative Fields?
Yes.
Representative Frock?
No.
Representative Ruffridge?
No.
Representative Sadler?
No.
Representative Wright?
No.
Representative Carrick?
Yes.
Chair Sumner?
No. So with 2 yeas and 5 nays, amendment number one has failed to pass. I will move amendment number 2.
Object, just to ask for explanation.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. And I will invite the bill sponsor to speak on amendment number 2.
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay. So amendment number 2 was an issue that was highlighted and flagged, or the concept of it, in House Resources. We discussed it there, but we felt it would be important again to discuss it in the Labor and Commerce Committee. So amendment number 2 would allow for a certain dual jurisdiction over LNG import facilities. And from our research, we found that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission already regulates rates, terms, and conditions of natural gas storage and associated activities. So we don't see there would be a need to have any sort of dual jurisdiction, nor could we find any precedents from looking at other LNG import facilities in the U.S., and we haven't found any of this dual jurisdiction over the rates of resale of gas, and we believe FERC does regulate the resale of gas, the storage, and the transportation. So we don't see this amendment as necessary. Thank you, Chair Sumner.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Following up through the chair to Representative McKay, I know that there are LNG export facilities and I guess maybe storage facilities in Louisiana, maybe Texas or Florida. Is there any other? Does your information you have available to you indicate any other states where this kind of, what you said, dual regulatory authority exists?
We have not found any evidence where there is this type of dual regulation and regulation. And if the committee or somebody were to bring it to us, we might be more open to the amendment, but we don't see it as necessary at this time.
Okay.
Thanks.
Representative Fields? I was just going to observe that it seems like it is better written in the amendment. It is more precise, and therefore I'm inclined to support it. Well, I'm going to withdraw it. So, without objection, amendment number 2 has been withdrawn. And thank you for getting that on the record. Brief at ease.
Okay, we're back on the record. Amendment number three by me. I move amendment number three.
Objection for purposes of discussion.
Okay, thank you, Representative Wright. And I will actually invite the bill sponsor if he would like to talk on amendment number three.
Mr. Chairman, with Tom McKay, House Resources, we support amendment number three, and I'll let Mr. Jepson describe that support.
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Chair McKay. We believe that amendment number three clarifies what should already be considered when looking and coming up with a just and reasonable rate. So we believe that the content in amendment three would already be considered, but we believe that clarifying that it will be in statute is necessary. Thank you, Chair Sumner. Okay.
Thank you. I remove my objection.
Actually,
the objection is removed. Do you object, Representative Sadler?
In order to discuss it further, yes, I will offer objection to amendment three.
Okay. Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So through the chair to the sponsor or staff, my reading of this is even if an LNG import or export facility is regulated only by FERC, and again, not by RCA, then the RCA may consider the cost of the utility's investment in that facility as a cost on which it can recover, you know, cost basis under an RCA rate case. Is that a fair assessment of what this means?
Representative Sadler through the chair, that is correct.
Okay. Follow-up question?
Yep.
So my question is, if we have an LNG facility that is regulated only by FERC, is there any place in the value chain or the process where any federal authority can include the investment in that LNG facility as the basis for any other cost? And it seems that there will be facilities, an import-export facility, compressors, et cetera, et cetera. Is that cost recovered by any other regulatory body?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I don't have an exact answer to that question. I don't think we can force the FERC to consider those costs. We would hope they would, but I don't think we can force them to. And I can get a better answer to you after committee.
Sure. Is Mr. Doyle, RCA Commissioner Doyle, still available to us? I'm not seeking to force, but I'm just curious if anyone else faxes it, essentially, recovers the cost.
I don't believe he's still. Is he? Commissioner or Robert Doyle, if you heard the question.
Yes, sir. I heard the question. This is Robert Doyle with the RCA through the chair. My understanding is very limited over what FERC can do in terms of the investment recovery of those costs, and I would have to do some research just as much as the sponsor that. Did they just mention Trevor? So I would have to do some research on FERC.
And again, Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, I'm not seeking to try and obtain that value or make sure the cost is recovered. I just wonder what the downstream effects would be of this amendment. So, no, I'm fairly satisfied. Thank you.
We also do have John Sims, president of NSTAR Natural Gas, on, and he may be quite knowledgeable about the situation. Mr. Sims, if you would possibly like to opine on this.
Yeah, so this is John Sims for the record, through the chair, Representative Sadler. Would you mind repeating your question again? I just want to make sure that I'm answering it fully and completely if I can.
Sure, thank you. Through the chair, John Sims, my question is this. If an import-export facility of LNG is regulated only by FERC, is there any other place where the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission includes the cost or value of that facility in any other regulated cost recovery rate case? In other words, is the value of that export-import facility provided for any place else in the value chain?
Yeah, that is a good question, Representative Sadler. I don't have enough experience in FERC regulation to be able to answer that completely. I apologize. I do just want to make a comment on record that the utilities, specifically NSTAR, is supportive of this language. From a clarity perspective, I think it's important prior to making any sort of investment that we have clear line of sight as what would be recovered and what wouldn't in rate. So apologize for not being able to answer your direct question, though.
Appreciate it, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, there is objection.
I will remove my objection. If the
okay. Without objection, amendment number 3 is passed. We have an amendment number 4 by Representative Fields.
Objection for purpose of discussion.
Oh, well, you have to wait till it's moved. Representative Fields. Thanks. I'll move amendment 4.
It's been a long day.
Okay.
Objection.
Okay. Representative Fields.
Thank you. So this is one of two major differences with the House and Senate versions of the bill over RCA regulation of gas. I think it's pretty clear from the language, fair market return on fair market value, that if this language remains in the bill, it could and almost certainly would lead to higher costs to utilities to store gas when the market, so the international price of gas, fluctuates. So, you know, you have a geopolitical disturbance. The price of gas goes up. That affects the fair market value, which in turn, under the statute, would, I think, force the RCA to look at a fair return on that fair market value. So the cost of gas is going to be largely constant based on what it takes to store the gas. I don't know why we would saddle our utilities and our customers with higher prices based on global events over which they have no control. So that's why I don't support the fair market value language being in here, because fair market value in a global market has nothing to do with the cost of storage.
Okay. Representative Wright?
I'd like to hear from the bill sponsor.
Thank you, Chair Sumner, to Representative Fields. If I understand correctly, this bill covers gas storage not only for gas produced from Cook Inlet, but it could also cover gas brought in by LNG imported. And we have no idea what that price might be. And you're exactly right. There could be market interruptions, wars, tsunamis, I suppose, whatever, that could affect that imported LNG price. So I believe we would be opposed to this amendment because we think that language should stay in the bill, if I understand correctly.
I might respond to that.
Maybe I don't understand the question.
Representative Fields?
Through the chair, I think it's actually a different subject. And just to play it out, you know, a utility buys gas and stores gas for a period of time. Hopefully the cost is linked to the actual cost of storage.
Where do they buy it?
From an LNG shipper. But the prices say it, you know, let's just say 10 MCF. Then subsequently you have global events which push the price up to, I don't know, 25 MCF. As I read this bill right now, you know, a fair return on fair market value, the bill could actually enable charging more for gas that is in storage based on, again, exogenous events. Now, I would also say, even if you were looking at the shipment of LNG in a tanker, why would we essentially be driving a higher cost under this bill instead of giving the utilities as much power to negotiate the lowest price possible?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I think I would throw this question to Mr. Doyle with the RCA, but certainly I don't think that it is our intent at all to purchase LNG at $10 an MCF and then a year later, because of world events, charge 15, you would charge what you paid for it. But I guess I'd ask Mr. Doyle, is that true?
Representative McKay, by my reading of the bill, it's a fair market return on the assets involved. So to read Section 2, I think that the representative is maybe objecting to the most. It says fair market value of oil and gas fields, drilling rigs, production platforms, wells, and similar assets. So you've invested in some assets and you're expecting a return on those assets. Mr. Doyle, if you heard the question, you could possibly address it.
Yes, sir. This is Robert Doyle from the RCA through the chair. I agree with this, the bill sponsor that those long-term contracts, you would basically be buying gas at a certain price. You'd be paying for injection. You'd be paying for pulling it back out. But I don't think the price is going to vary in a long-term contract that's been negotiated between the parties based upon the events that happen, you know, during the period of time that it's being stored. And I do agree with the chair in terms of my understanding is we'll be asked to take a look at fair market value of the assets. And a lot of those things, when we first get started, there'll be inception rates, and then there'll be a process by which we go through a revenue requirement with actual year's expenses after we've set a test year to determine future rates on those assets as need be. So I hope I answered the question.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair to Commissioner Doyle. Well, first off, the amendment would propose to delete from the bill page 4, lines 12 through 13 related to dismantlement, removal, and restoration. I think allowing for the cost of DRR&R is a legitimate thing and that should not be removed. But the question to, through the chair to Mr. Commissioner Doyle is, the crux of the question in my mind is the definition of the costs of oil and gas fields. I think the amendment is presuming that the value of the gas in the field maybe is what he's concerned about. But I guess I'll ask Commissioner Doyle, the cost of oil and gas fields, how would the RCA consider that or determine that? What's included in oil and gas fields?
Through the chair, this is Robert Doyle with the RCA. It's a little bit easier when you actually have a buyer when you're talking about fair market values. For example, you know, if somebody buys an existing field from Marathon, that's a set price. After that, then the investment in terms of what you need to do for compressors and what have you, when you the time you buy it at the acquisition price, you know, that's easy for us. Some of it, what we're talking about now is legacy fields and how some of that is going to be done. And I think, as I've testified before, I think some of this is going to have to be worked out through a hearing process where the parties are going to bring the information to us, and we're going to take a look at those things and come up with a decision after we have all the facts on the record. We're not going to create our own record, and so some of that's going to have to be through a normal docket process and a hearing process. But you are correct about the DRR&R. I understand, you know, that whole issue is separate. So I hope I answered the question.
I think so. And through the chair, I guess I'd like to try and answer a question should one arise later. It would be my intention in voting against this amendment and for the bill, I hope I can get the chance to do that, is that the value of the oil and gas itself in a field would not be the basis for the cost unless RCA determines that's part of the methodology they want to use. But I think the methodology of using the initial acquisition cost is probably more appropriate. It would not be my intention to see an endlessly fluctuating series of calculations about the value of oil and gas on a world commodity market, providing the basis for RCA's cost basis for gas storage. So that would not be my intent. Thanks.
Representative Sadler, I would maybe clarify that a little bit. So I do think, given that we're talking about storing gas here, that sort of the blended cost of the cushion gas and the working gas would be considered in the rates, although I don't believe it would be factual that price would fluctuate by market conditions. I think they get a fair market return on the value of what they put in, but if I'm wrong, perhaps the bill sponsor could address that.
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay. The fair market value language is only regarding assets. It's not regarding the sale of gas. And I can give a little bit of context on why that's in the bill. So currently, we only have the one gas storage facility in the state, which is CINGSA, operated by a utility. And the current methodology of straight line depreciation that the RCA uses works fairly well for that asset. However, now we're talking about bringing online assets that have been around for decades in some cases and have had millions of dollars invested into them. So what the fair market value language is doing is it's clarifying to the private industry that we're not just going to say, what'd you purchase the asset for and how old is it? We're going to take into context investments made into that asset when we're coming up with the fair, just, and reasonable rate. Thank you, Chair Sumner, if that explains the issue correctly or adequately.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I think that does state the case more clearly than I did. So what he said, yes.
Okay. Well, there is objection. Please call the roll on amendment number 4.
Representative Carrick?
Yes.
Representative Fields?
Yes.
Representative Crox?
No.
Representative Ruffridge?
No.
Representative Sadler?
No.
Representative Wright?
No.
Chair Sumner?
No.
2 yeas, 5 nays.
And with 2 yeas and 5 nays, amendment number 4 has failed to pass. Amendment number 5, Representative Fields.
I move amendment 5.
Okay. Representative Fields.
Thank you. This is a significantly narrower version addressing confidentiality. So if this amendment was adopted, the RCA would be able to review data, the public and competitors of a respective company would not, because this amendment would preserve that records are confidential from the Alaska Public Records Act. So I think it's worthwhile that a regulator be able to review the records. I don't actually think the public or competitors should be able to review them. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we just got a copy of Amendment 5, so we kind of like just a second to...
Please.
Brief at ease.
All right, we're back on the record. Representative McKay, did you have a comment?
Closing comment? Or we got to do amendment 5. Right.
We are still on amendment 5.
Yes.
Yes.
We think amendment 5 is not necessary.
Not necessary. Representative Fields.
Thank you. Maybe if I could ask through the chair to Mr. Doyle. Mr. Doyle, my intention with this amendment was to preserve RCA's authority to look at company records without making those records broadly available to the public or competitors. Does the bill, in the absence of this amendment, give you that authority to look at records the company's providing gas storage?
Mr. Doyle, if you heard
the...
Yep.
Through the chair, this is Robert Doyle with the RCA. I believe that the current bill as written gives us the authority as the RCA to look at the financial records that we need to look at.
If I could just ask a follow-up. You said the financial records that you need to look at. Is there anything in the bill as written before this amendment that restricts your ability as the RCA to look at any relevant records related to gas storage? Thank you.
Through the chair, this is Robert Doyle with the RCA. As I read the bill, and as I understand the bill, it allows us to get the information we need to regulate it in the same manner that we're regulating the current gas storage facilities that we have. So I believe we would have the information that we need to carry out the mandate from the statute.
Okay, good. In that case, I'll withdraw the amendment. Thank you.
Okay, amendment number 5 has been withdrawn. Seeing no other business before the committee on House Bill 313, Vice Chair Ruffridge, do you have a motion?
Good
evening. Oh, excuse me. 394.
Excellent. Thank you, Chair Sumner. I would move House Bill number 394, version A, also referred to as 33-LS1441/U, be advanced from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note and with amendments.
Object.
Okay, there is objection. Please call the roll on House Bill 394.
Representative Wright.
Yes.
Representative Carrick.
No.
Representative Fields.
No.
Representative Crox.
Yes.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Version A? Brief at ease. I'm sorry.
Brief at ease.
I heard the motion as version A. I'm looking at version
Okay, we're back on the record. The roll is voided. Please call the roll.
Representative Wright?
Yes.
Representative Carrick?
No.
Representative Fields?
No.
Representative Crox?
Yes.
Representative Ruffridge?
Yes.
Representative Sadler?
Yes.
Chair Sumner?
Yes.
Five yeas, two nays.
Five yeas and two nays.
House Bill 394 will be reported from committee. Next on the agenda, we had House Bill. Thank you, Representative McKay. We had House Bill 375, but we are going to roll this, I believe, to Monday. And then we have last on today's agenda, House Bill 325, business license fees from Representative Mina's office. We have a new version to adopt today. Vice Chair Ruffridge, do you have a motion?
Yes, thank you, Chair Sumner. I move to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill number 325. Version S, also referred to as 33-LS1090/S.
Okay, without objection, the committee substitute has been adopted. I'd now like to invite Representative Mina and her staff to please approach the committee, put your names on the record, and begin.
Thank you, Chair Sumner and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, Genevieve Mina, House District 19. Representative, I'm here with my staff, Remington Purnell. Before I give a bill presentation, since the committee just moved a new committee substitute, I'll have my staff review the summary of changes from the original bill to the CS.
Okay, thank you.
Hi there. Thank you, Chair Sumner. I will go ahead and review the changes from version B to version S of HB 325. Section 1 removes investigation fees as a fee type that is set in regulation by the Department for Professional Licenses. Section 2 removes the definition of regulatory costs from AS0801065C. Section 3, the definition of regulatory costs is relocated to this section with an added clarification that regulatory costs does not include disciplinary investigations or actions involving unlicensed practice or legal and actual costs associated with complaints, hearings, mediation, and settlements. Sections 4 through 10 make conforming changes. Section 4 removes references to fees for investigation. Section 5 removes reference to investigation fees for massage therapists. Section 6 and 7 removes reference to investigation fees for marine pilots. Section 8 replaces investigation fees with evaluation fees for nursing home administrators. This is for clarity, as investigation means evaluation in this context. Section 9 replaces investigation fees with evaluation fees for pharmacists and pharmacies. This is, again, for clarity, same for Section 8. Section 10 replaces investigation fees with evaluation for veterinarians. This is for clarity, same again as Section 8. Section 11, HB 325 version B specified that all first-time business license fees would be set as $0. HB 325 version S removes this and instead adds a new subsection specifying a new exemption for paying the full business license fee if a business is a sole proprietor and that sole proprietor or is sole proprietorship and that sole proprietor receives public assistance, then the fee is $0. And finally, Section 12 sets the effective date to July 1st, 2024. And for the record, Remington Purnell, staff for Remina.
Well, thank you. And some of that sounds a little familiar. Do committee members have questions for Representative Mina or her staff? No? Oh, Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. If I can just give a brief overview of the bill. Genevieve Mina, for the record, House District 19 Representative. Thank you to my staff, Remington, for giving the summary of changes. This bill seeks to strengthen our economy by empowering economically disadvantaged Alaskans to receive public benefits to pursue entrepreneurship. It's a bill that focuses on empowering our private sector and also promoting self-sufficiency. House Bill 325 and its committee substitute seeks to continue waiving business license fees, specifically sole proprietorships, for Alaskans receiving public assistance. And with the summary of changes in the CS that my staff went over, the CS also incorporates language from House Bill 314, which I believe the committee has heard, which is related to occupational licensing fees. If there are questions about those components of the bill from 314, I will defer to the department on some of those questions. The bill focuses on addressing the issues of the decline in entrepreneurship that we've seen in our nation since the 70s. Entrepreneurship and the growth of small businesses has fallen by nearly 50%, and we know that small businesses are essential to a strong economy. According to a 2017 study by America's Small Business Development Corporation, around 41% of Americans say they would start their dream business in 6 months, but only 2% do. Anyone can be an entrepreneur. It's not just a dream for someone from specific backgrounds, but currently, business license fees are prohibitive for some Alaskans who come from economically disadvantaged backgrounds. This bill is specific to Alaskans who are receiving a public benefit. After a public benefit, these Alaskans have limited discretionary income, which restricts their ability to gain upward economic mobility through other means, such as starting a business and getting off of public benefits. And although currently the business license fee is $50, which might be seem minimal to us, it can be the difference between buying groceries, paying an electric bill, and taking care of your family for many individuals on public assistance. I know this committee has heard different bills about business license fees, occupational license fees, raising those fees in different ways. And what I want to make sure with this bill is that we still have an ability for Alaskans to start a business. One other factor that I want to touch upon, during COVID-19, the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development suspended business license fees, resulting in an increase of active businesses in the state. We want to continue on that progress from the pandemic and help invigorate new opportunities for people who never thought that they could be able to start a business to be able to take that opportunity. I'm happy to answer any questions about the bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've not reviewed this bill yet, but through the chair to the sponsor, I think I hear you saying, well, are you saying that the $25 delta between the current business license fee and the license fee you would propose under this, that's what's going to make a difference, and that's what's going to improve entrepreneurship levels? $25?
Thank you for the question, Representative Sadler. Through the chair, this bill proposes actually waiving the business license fee altogether. Currently, the business license fee is $50. There's two exceptions for that fee. The first is for seniors who are 65 and older, and that is an exemption from $50 to $25. That exemption was added in 2003. Additionally, there was a disabled veteran exemption that was passed in 2014, and that also has an exemption from $50 to 25%. We already have different exemptions and statutes for different population groups, but anecdotally from working with different economic development organizations and people who work with people from low-income backgrounds who want to start their own businesses, $50 can be very prohibitive. And it is one barrier in the multiple different financial barriers for someone to start a small business, but if we can make that process a little bit easier for someone, I think that's worth it.
So I stand corrected through the chair to the sponsor. So you're saying that the waiver of either a $50 fee or reducing it to $25 fee is going to make a significant difference in the ability of a small entrepreneur to start a business. Is that what you're saying?
Thank you for the question, Rep. Sadler. Through the chair, to clarify, it would waive it from $50 to $0, but yes.
Okay. And I guess I'll follow up. Is it you do cite in your sponsor statement that since the 70s had a 50% decrease in American entrepreneurship, is it at all possible that the increased level of state and federal regulation might be playing as much role in inhibiting entrepreneurship as the $50 cost of the business license?
Thank you for the question, Rep. Sadler, through the chair. That may be a factor, and I think additional bureaucracy, including the fees related to a business license, can be a component to that.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair, to the bill sponsor. What was the business license fee during the COVID pandemic? I seem to remember it was decreased or eliminated altogether for a period of time. And during that time, did we see an increase in the number of business licenses applied for?
Thank you for the question, Rep. Carrick. Through the chair, during the pandemic, business license fees were waived altogether, and so it was $0 to get a business license. And anecdotally, there was an increase in active business licenses, but I would be happy to defer that question to Director Sylvan Robb of CBPO.
We do have Sylvan Robb here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Through the chair to Representative Carrick, The bill sponsor is correct that the business license fee was waived entirely from April 3rd of 2020 through January 31st of 2023. During that period, we did see an increase in the number of business licenses that were acquired. We do not ask people why they do that, and so wouldn't want to speculate on the reason for that. But.
Follow-up? So through the chair, it's correlational, but the number of licenses for sole proprietorships did go up during the time business license fees were waived.
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, I would have to check on whether they were sole proprietorships. Across the board, we saw an increase in business licenses for all types of businesses.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Anybody else? No?
Well, just for the record.
Representative Prox?
I'm sorry, I don't have a fiscal note in my packet. I don't know if there was one, but the point of the license, was to be on record, I guess. But does the division funds itself roughly through business license fees? Is that correct?
Through the chair to Representative Prox, business license fees, the division is self-supporting through the fees that we collect for corporate registrations, business licenses, and professional licensing. Business licenses do generate additional income beyond the cost to run that program. Those additional fees lapse to the general fund.
Yeah, I think we covered this already, Representative Prox. It's essentially a tax because they collect a surplus. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Okay, seeing no other questions before the committee, we're going to set this bill aside for a future hearing. I will set an amendment deadline for Tuesday, April 23rd at 4 p.m. Is there any other? No? Okay.
Brief at ease.
Oh. We are back on the record. Is there any other business before the committee? No? Okay. Seeing no other business, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 5:17 p.m.